Talk given Saturday, 16th December 1972. We have dealt so far in our considerations regarding the gods of the Rig Veda with Varuna and Indra. Last time we dealt with certain extremely important aspects in connection with Indra, and the significance for us individually in realizing what Indra stood for. Indra is presented as the personal God of heaven, and as such he typifies the point of supreme realization by the human being here now. Indra's abode, as one may say, as far as each of us is concerned, is the crown center, that is, the combination of the chakra or center of psychic energy, which is symbolically said to be situated between the eyebrows, plus the one at the top of the head associated with the brain, the thousand-petaled lotus. That is Indra's abode. And we also saw that Indra is presented in the hymns of the Rig Veda, amongst other aspects of his, endowed with these two aspects particularly. He's the bountiful one, and as the Veda says, he's the slayer of the demon Vritra. Ahi Vritra, meaning the serpent Vritra, who withholds the waters of eternal life. And when Indra slays the demon, the waters flow freely and suffuse our whole being, which means that one's whole being is now completely spiritualized. One's life in the world, therefore, is the religious life in the supreme sense of the term. And its most important manifestation is the fact that one lives the virtuous life par excellence. Always bear in mind, virtue in these contexts is not to be understood as merely the opposite of vice. It is not our ordinary conception of virtue belonging to the dualistic sphere, to our ambivalent psychical condition. Love, hate, cruelty, kindness, and all that sort of thing. This is virtue in its absolute sense. Virtue which is a creative power, and which in manifestation in our life naturally gets translated in terms of the moral values like love, goodness, and beauty, and so forth. It's virtue in that sense which is manifested when Indra has entered into his own kingdom as Lord of the kingdom. You must bear in mind that the Rig Veda presents the universe in three aspects: heaven, the middle region, and earth. In ourselves, that is to say, in the psychophysical organism, heaven is associated with the brain. It is a very curious thing that when the Rig Veda talks of heaven, they talk of the two halves which are joined together. No one has ever really solved that problem as to what that means precisely. There was a very interesting man in India, a doctor, who showed clearly in his book, which he wrote, that the descriptions in the Veda, the details of the descriptions, were such as to fit into the actual physical body as such. These are the two halves, the two parts of the head, which practically join together there. They are presented in the Veda as two inverted bowls facing each other. Then the middle region refers to the region of the medulla, and then earth is presented as an upright rod with a central canal. What else is it but your spinal column? Now, Indra's realm as Lord of Heaven is here. All right. When one has realized complete purity, when the moralities are perfectly fulfilled, when the power of attentiveness functions naturally, freely, in full development, and when all one's sense activities and functions and one's daily life is in harmony with all this, then surely the Lord of Heaven is on his throne ruling his world. And you may recall time and again I've said that the words earth, or sometimes universe, in the scriptures of the world, stand fundamentally, first and foremost, for one's own living psychophysical organism. That is what they stand for. So now, this serpent which Indra slays, is set to slay, is the serpent as such in its wholeness represents life, the life energy in all its aspects, biological, psychical, and spiritual. That serpent is not slain by Indra, although that is the way in which it is put verbally in the old scriptures. If you slay the serpent who represents life, well, that's the end of the whole job. There is no more living, either religious or irreligious, obviously. That serpent is transformed. That serpent is the power which impels, which draws you on, which incites you, which tempts you to enter deeper and deeper into your own being. This is what life does to us all the time. And when we have taken a step towards understanding and towards fulfilling the life urge in its true sense, and we have built a form, a way of life, a routine, then our psyche, ambivalent as it is, and also fearful as it is, wants to preserve that for the rest of one's days. Then this life power, which is creative energy, breaks that form and says, out with it. You've had enough of that. You've learnt your lesson. Now for the next step ahead. And this is something which we human beings find so difficult to understand and to accept as the way of life itself. The way of life is a perpetual life-death pulsation. And remember, death really means other life. It's life, other life, life, other life. But that other life is as death to life as we experience it, simply because we experience it in terms of limitation and we want to preserve the limitation. But then this same power of life breaks that, disrupts that form into other life itself, which is universal, formless, shapeless, and so forth. Back it comes into life, and so forth. And we, the poor human being involved in it, are tossed and turned this way and that way, and all sorts of inexplicable things happen. But if we really care for what matters, for the truth, then this same life power gradually enlightens us till we understand that this is the way life energy functions. And then we do not want to thwart the transcendent purpose and the transcendent nature of the activity of life itself. Now you remember I tried to explain how this slaying of the serpent, Ahivritra, is really a complete understanding of that in us which locks up life energy and does not allow it, as we commonly say, to flow upwards into the spiritual realm, into spiritual living. And there is that other counterpart of Ahivritra, which is Ahibudhnya, the dragon of the deep. That vast unconscious realm which holds all the great archetypal forces, transcendent forces of which modern science doesn't know anything specially yet, but which probably science in course of time, through its movement, will be able to touch and investigate in its own way. This dragon of the deep holds all those archetypal energies. And those archetypal energies really are the waters of life abundant, which flow through us quite freely. Now do not imagine this as forces in the sense that we know of electricity or heat or anything else as energies and forces. Don't think of it that way. I can't explain, and I doubt if anybody can explain, because the realm of thought and word is so restricted, so limited, that these things which can be sensed and which can be experienced cannot be described. That is the whole point. You can only state that something like this is the case. So these transcendent energies work And you might say, well, what is their special work? What do they do? Would they cure my bellyache? Of course not. Just like that. They transform your mental functioning. That is the point. They completely transform your whole attitude to life. And if they once transform your attitude to life in a manner which puts you into direct relationship and touch with what is really truth, goodness, beauty, wisdom, love, then you are released into your true humanity. The purpose of existence is fulfilled. This is the way transcendence works. It does not work in terms of any of our criteria or standards or values at all. Because our thought-out and verbalized statements with regard to the supreme things are always mistaken statements. They are false statements. Although they may have just that bit of reality in them which can urge us along the right lines. That is all. But when these transcendent energies work, then that spiritual reality which is in us becomes an actual fact in operation. And generally speaking, we are unaware of it. That is to say, we don't see it operating. We don't see results, as we call them. We are it. That is all. The sun is the sun. It doesn't know and say to anybody or send a bill to anybody for radiating out its light and heat and all the rest of it. It keeps no records of it at all. It just shines. God Almighty. See, that is how we as living beings should live. Just live. A pure human being. So now you see, when Indra effects the work of transmuting Ahivritra and the most factual and powerful expression in our everyday existence of Ahivritra is in terms of sexuality, because that is the most positive assertion of our separate selfhood. When we see that it is this separativeness in our consciousness which lies at the root of the conflict and discord between ourselves and the world, Ahivritra is no longer our enemy, but is our obedient servant. And the waters of eternal life are let loose. Ahibudhnya, the dragon of the deep, is no longer prevented from functioning freely through us. This is one of, I believe, a deep and a true way, or more or less true way, of understanding the meaning of the god Indra. And of course, those old people anthropomorphized what they actually realized through their religious living. Religious living in the supreme and the true sense of the word. And since in those days they had no other means of putting this sort of thing into language, it was impossible for them to avoid anthropomorphizing the energies which they experienced. That is all. Now, let us leave Indra alone, if we can, and turn to the god Agni, the lord of fire. Now, with Agni, we find that the Rig Veda states that he is the firstborn of holy order, Ritta. Ritta, from which our word rite, R-I-T-E, is derived. He is the firstborn of Ritta. Ritta is the eternal order of things, inherent in existence itself. The eternal that which is. It contains within itself that power by which cosmos emerges out of chaos. Chaos in this context is not to be understood as this as disturbance or disorganization, not in our modern meaning of the word chaos, a complete mess, or but chaos means the primordial state which is characterless, so to say, which is just universal stuff doing nothing. When that universal stuff, in that universal stuff doing nothing, there emerges activity, movement, formation, finite limited things bearing relationship to each other in a harmony and according to what we in our way call the laws of nature and so forth, then we have cosmos emerging out of the original stuff, chaos. If you like to take a simile, to look at a simile in our personal life, perhaps one of the best similes would be the work of a sculptor upon, say, a block of marble. Your block of marble is perfectly quiet. It doesn't hurt anybody. It just is there, a block of marble. There's nothing wrong with that block of marble. It's not in a state of disharmony or disorder or anything. It is just a block of marble. Now your sculptor sets to work, and lo and behold, he releases a wonderful statue, or whatever he wants to release, or several statues, or whatever it is. See, it's something like that. So cosmos emerges out of chaos that way. Now this is the power of Ritta, the fundamental eternal order of things, inherent in existence. And Agni, the Lord of Fire, is said to be the firstborn of holy order. You must be warned about one difficulty in connection with the Rig Veda, amongst other difficulties. All the gods are spoken of, often, in very much the same terms. For instance, you will also find Kama, which is the Indian correspondent of the Greek Eros, as the first of the gods who confers immortality upon all the others. So you find Kama in the Indian presentation. You also find Agni, firstborn of holy order. He also is the conferrer of immortality upon gods and men alike. Very strange thing. You see, try and really feel this right now. Get aware of it. We are wholes, wholes, wholes. Our living process is a whole process. Our awareness process, our sensing, and the activity of our of the sensitivity of our living being is continuously a whole process. Everything happens simultaneously. See, it's not as if we live in separate bits. 8 to 10, so-and-so, 10 to 12, 12 o'clock, so-and-so, 12 to 2, something else, and so forth. We live wholly, continuously. We are aware also, wholly, continuously. We sense and feel the whole, our whole world and ourselves, wholly and continuously. But the brain being what it is, and the knowing process, what we call the knowing process in our ordinary daily life being what it is, we are forced to separate out the parts constituting the whole. We are forced to deal with each one which composes the many in order to understand the overall whole. But what happens in actuality is that we try to understand the separate parts and forget to understand the wholeness of it. We get hold of the manyness and we lose the oneness. Now this is one of the difficulties in dealing with the Rig Veda. But because these people realize this, they described all the gods in very much the same terms. But always there was an emphasis upon one aspect, perhaps more than other aspects. The emphasis does come in. Varuna, as we saw, is the embodied transcendent virtue. He is the moral governor of the universe. Indra, the Lord of Heaven, is the bountiful one, the victor. He is the victorious one. He is the Lord God of hosts, so to say. And whom does he conquer? All the enemies that are spoken of. He conquers all the demons within our own nature. All the evil things in our own nature. That is how he's presented, you see. Now, with Agni, he's the firstborn of holy order. And he has three main stations. He is the sun in heaven, the lightning in the firmament, and the altar fire on earth. Now this is all symbolic, of course. This is of special interest to comparative religionists because this is probably the earliest presentation of the idea of a trinity. It's the earliest presentation in the whole of Indo-European religious development. Agni is the first trinity as such. The sun in heaven, lightning in the firmament, the altar fire on earth. Now, the hymns to Agni are some of the loveliest in the Rig Veda. There are 10 books of the Rig Veda. With the exception of the 8th and the 9th book, the first hymn in all the other books is always a hymn to Agni to start with. Agni is, in a certain respect, the Lord of the sacrifice. The fire is used for sacrificial purposes, always. In every religious ceremony, we find something to do with fire where a sacrificial ritual is concerned. And remember, sacrifice not in the rather poor sense of destroying something in order to placate, not as a placatory rite, but in the sense of making sacred. Because the fire makes sacred. The fire is the great purifier. That is why. I should like to read this hymn to Agni, which starts the second book. Thou, Agni, shining in thy glory through the days, art brought to life from out the waters, from the stone, from out the forest trees and herbs that grow on ground. Thou, sovereign Lord of men, art generated pure. Thine is the herald's task, and cleanser's duly timed. Leader art thou, and kindler for the pious man. Thou art director, thou the ministering priest. Thou art the Brahman, Lord and Master in our home. Now, I should explain that second verse there. You see, Agni performs the functions of every type of priest. And in the Rig Vedic ritual, the herald is the one who invokes the gods. Of course, when the ritual is carried out, there are several different men, each one of whom plays this particular part. There is the Hotar, or herald, who invokes the gods. The Potar, purifier or cleanser, who is the assistant of the Brahman or praying priest, who remedies any defect in the ritual. The Neshtar, or leader, who leads forward the wife of the sacrificer. Now, this is a very important point to bear in mind. In the early days, when the Rig Veda was the great religious document of the Aryan peoples in India, the wife was on an equal footing with her husband. And the supreme evidence of this, as a matter of fact, this point has been shown by European scholars since the last century. They have shown that since she was on equal terms with her husband in carrying out the religious rituals, the woman was very definitely on an equal footing with her husband. In the home, she was absolute ruler. In the field, the husband was the absolute ruler. Those were their separate spheres. But where the religious ritual was concerned, they were on equal terms. So, the Neshtar, or leader, was the priest who led forward the wife of the sacrificer. The Agnid, or Kinla, was the one who lit the sacrificial fire. The Prashastar, or director, who is the assistant of the Hotar, and the Hotar is the herald who invokes all the gods. And the Advaryu, or ministering priest, who is the deacon who measures the ground, builds the altar, and makes all the preparations necessary for the sacrifice. So, the god Agni, Agni's essential and archetypal priesthood is his outstanding feature. The priest is one who is a ceremonial magician. To this day in India, if you are lucky enough, you may come across the performance of some of these ancient rituals in a manner which, if you are privileged to be present, you will never forget, because it actually does affect such a considerable transformation in your own being. I have met one or two of these people, and it really is extraordinary, the change that takes place. These priests were people who, through living the religious life, had released within themselves these psychical, psycho-mental powers, which enabled them, when conducting the ritual, so to direct this transcendent mental energy through themselves towards their congregation, that the whole congregation was changed thereby. Ceremonial magic was a very great reality, particularly in those days. And that is why this ancient Vedic ritual was so very important. It cleansed the whole of the psycho-mental atmosphere, and it changed the life of the people in all their other spheres of existence, social, economic, political, because all these other spheres are the expressions of what you yourself are within yourself. If I change, then my politics, economics, my daily life, my activities, everything changes. See, and way back, so many millennia ago, people knew that and understood it. And that is why India has always preserved this great principle: change the person by his living the religious life, and you change everything around him. If intellectually you work out a system and impose it upon the people with the belief, and it may be a justifiable belief, that this will change the life of the people for the better, yes, all right, it will be for the better from worldly standards. But you will find that in practically every instance in history, that betterment or apparent betterment may have had a short innings, and then it peters out, because the people concerned are not changed, and their greeds and jealousies and ambitions and resentments and everything burst out somewhere, somehow. And therefore, there is no real progress. But if the living being changes, then everything changes with him. That's that. So those people understood this kind of thing. Let me read you another hymn to Agni, which is really very, very magnificent. This comes from the 10th book. The very first hymn. High hath the mighty risen before the dawning, and come to us with light from out the darkness. Fair-bodied Agni with his radiant splendor hath filled at birth all human habitations. Thou, being born, art child of earth and heaven, parted among the plants in beauty, Agni. The glooms of night thou, brilliant babe, hast conquered and art come forth, loud roaring from thy mothers. Here, being manifested, lofty Vishnu, full wise, protects his own supremest station. When they have offered in his mouth their sweet milk, to him with one accord they sing forth praises. Priest of the holy rite, with car that glitters, refulgent banner of each act of worship, sharing in every god through might and glory, even Agni, guest of men, I summon hither. So Agni stands on earth's most central station, invested in well-decorated garments. Born red of hue, where men pour out libations, O King, as great high priest bring the gods hither. Over the earth and over heaven, O Agni, thou, Sun, hast ever spread above thy parents. Come, youthfulest, to those who long to meet thee, and hither bring the gods, O mighty victor. You know, these hymns, one should just take a hymn and meditate on it for a whole week or at least, and you'll get extraordinary insights. When you see all that is involved in the hymns. Now, as I've said before, first and foremost, all these things apply to us, ourselves. Agni is Lord of fire. In what forms do we know fire in our own being? Recall again the fact that the knowledge of yoga is very, very ancient. Goes back probably 5,000 years at least. And this knowledge was known in its fullness as far back as that time. Now, Agni, fire which works through all the chakras, the centers of psychical energy, the seven centers, as we call them, in the body itself. First of all, we know only too well what is meant by fire as sexual fire. A purely sexual drive, which is our heritage from nature itself. It doesn't need human thought or feeling to it. It is there by nature, so to say. There is the digestive fire, which functions at the center, at the navel, as we call it. And in actual fact, it deals with physical digestion as well as psychical digestion, meaning the digestion of our sense impressions, our thoughts and feelings, our reactions and all the rest of it. There is also the fever. I'm using the word fever not in the sense of an illness in this case. There is that fever, that fire, which burns up the diseased state. And the ordinary fever which we go through when we fall ill is supposed to do precisely that. That burning up, that higher temperature of the body is the process by which the body is trying to free itself from what is harmful to it. Its diseased state. This again is a manifestation of Agni, the Lord of fire. Then we have the psychic aspect. Anger is a fire, is it not? And anger is a fire on the destructive side. It undergoes change when it becomes what we are pleased to call righteous indignation. Until any such fire, which has its destructive aspect, is changed into pure passion, which is a fire. When passion becomes really pure, it is our psychical capital, so to say, which we can invest rightly. It gives us the drive, that constant drive towards fulfillment. Now, passion purified, pure passion means that there is no self in it. It's nothing which I want. It must be free of the person wanting to do good. It must be free of my desiring to serve man or God or anything. It just is pure passion manifesting itself. It happens and it functions neither because of nor despite me. Do try and get hold of this idea. Of this fact that in religious living, the right thing, the perfect thing, the religious thing happens neither because of nor despite oneself. It is the natural process. It is ritha, the eternal order of things. It is inherent in your being. It is the all-encompassing, universal, transcendent power which just functions freely. Because I, the person, the separate person, having being pure, do not obstruct it. You know, this is perhaps one of the most important aspects in the living of the holy life. It is the real sign that here is holiness functioning. It's not that I am holy, not at all. But holiness functions because I have ceased to be unholy. You see, now that is passion. In the pure sense, the true sense. It is a passion which does not consume you. It is a passion which you do not expend. There is no squandering. It is the abundant life of the dragon of the deep, flowing freely. You see, I'm emphasizing this aspect because in the recorded teachings of practically all the religions, no, perhaps not all, it doesn't come in Islam and Zarathustrianism in the same way. It doesn't. But certainly in Hinduism and Buddhism, supreme emphasis is laid upon desirelessness. Now it must be clearly understood that desirelessness means that I, as a separate, isolatively self-conscious person, must be free of any desire. Because so long as there is this isolative self-consciousness at work, that desire is always self-oriented in some way or other. It is never selfless. And as long as it is never selfless, it will always obstruct the transcendent real from free functioning. You see the point? It's as clear as the pikestaff, really. But somehow, the best amongst us keep missing to see the pikestaff. So, desirelessness in that sense only. It doesn't mean that you just become withered old, lifeless bit of nonsense. Far from it. You are tremendously energetic. You are enthusiastic then in the real sense, filled with theos, God. That's the meaning of enthusiastic. And that is this pure passion. Because oneself has ceased to be unholy. And this pure passion, which is energy, power, drive, in line with, in harmony with, Ritta, the eternal order of things, comes into being. Look, if you read, if we study the lives of the holy ones, do we ever think of those lives in terms of anything but wonderful beauty? Would we say that the life of a Jesus or a Buddha or a Krishna or a Zarathustra or a Prajapati Parameshthin or any one of those great teachers was ugly? We wouldn't say their life was ugly. And certainly their inner life, they themselves, the exemplars. So, that's how it is. There's perfect beauty there. And all this centers around the release of this pure passion, which is the energy of transcendence. Look at passion that way. So when passion rises up in us, in this, that, or the other form, look at it very clearly. Steadily. Don't try to gratify it. Don't try to fight against it. Look at it. Be completely and wholly aware of it. And see it for what it is. And if you stay quiet and look at it, it in its purity and perfection will take you on a tide of bliss to your own perfection. And there's no regret afterwards, no remorse. And far more important, there is no feeling afterwards, oh, I wish I could have it again. Because you'll be right beyond that petty sphere of taking the experience as a thing, a particular thing. It is not a particular thing. It is not finite. It is infinite. When you really listen to great music, for instance, when you really look at an exquisite sunset or the glittering of the stars at night, you must have seen that time and again in Canada. Well, there you are, you see. When you really experience anything like that, there is no possessiveness attached to it. There is no finitude attached to it. And therefore, because it's not finite, you can't put it in your pocket. And that means you are free. And if you are free, you are joyous in the true sense. That is the way to enjoy life. How little we know how to enjoy life. All right. Then there is Agni as psychic heat, what the Tibetans call tummo. This is one of the yoga practices, the liberation of psychic heat, which leads to the fire of inspiration. And in this situation, the god Agni and the god Soma become interchangeable, one and the same. And finally, there is the creative fire of transcendence itself. Is this the fire that Prometheus stole? He never stole it. He brought it down from heaven for man. And Zeus, who, amongst other things, represents the controlling, in the sense of restrictive, father figure, therefore chained Prometheus on the rock, and an eagle came and ate his liver every night, and it healed during the day, and that was his torment, until Heracles comes and liberates him. But Heracles is the child of Zeus himself. Work this myth out carefully for yourself. The Lord of Olympus, Zeus is Indra, remember, also acts as a restrictive power. And acting as a restrictive power, the person feels torment until the son of this celestial restrictive power by a mortal woman, the man-god Heracles, comes and liberates you, the person, Prometheus, from your torment. It has wonderful significance. And it applies to our daily life all the time. So, we'll stop there today. Agni as the creative fire of transcendence itself. And remember that Agni, fire, heat, has to be present always as long as there is the manifestation of life. As long as there is the activity of life, whether it be in physical terms, material terms, or psycho-mental terms, or transcendent spiritual terms.